Let's see. I have Michelle, Kathy, Scott, Elizabeth, Jeff, Tina, Tatiana, Peter, Mike, Dan, Dale, and Bill. Is there anyone else on the call that I haven't mentioned?
Deepak.
Oh, Deepak. I'm sorry. I have you highlighted. That's what I missed you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and get started. Ed's on vacation, and I think Michael's on a meeting, all-day meeting. But Jill sent out the agenda, and I actually thought it might be good for us to start with the publications policy update. And Tatiana was going to share her computer screen to just kind of give an update of the discussion that this committee's had. So, Jill, can we move it to Tatiana? Does everyone have the WebEx up?
I'm pulling it up now.
Do I have to do something? Ah, share my desktop. All right. All right. Can you all see my messy email right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I see.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through the process that we – well, let me put this in the same place. So, sorry. I'm not as savvy as this is the rest of you. Okay, so what we talked about, we had a call, right, I don't know, seems like forever, but it was right before I went on vacation, which I guess is sort of forever. And part of the things, let me just summarize kind of the discussion we had. So we had John Hannigan, we had...
Tatiana, it's
yes?
Bill. I think it's showing your other screen. It's showing like an analysis for AIM-2 paper.
Oh, yeah. All right, hold on. That would be another grant. You don't want to... All right, can you see it now?
Yep.
Perfect.
Yep.
Sorry about that. You probably were all trying to figure out what I was doing with prenatal difficulties. Okay, so we had a call, and if you remember, what we were discussing was how to come up with kind of a, it started as a publication policy, sort of how do we develop ways in which we identify collaborations, identify who should be authors on papers, make sure that we have all the key elements of papers. And in having the discussion, and actually Kathy wasn't on the call but sent really important emails prior, as did Sarah, and then John Hannigan did as well. So everyone sort of kind of started to circle around the same thing, which was, is it really a publication policy or is it really kind of a two-piece that we need, kind of a concept review and a publication policy, and how do they both fit together? And so what I'm going to walk you through is sort of what we like to propose. It's not done yet, but I first want to make sure that everyone likes the idea and thinks that this would work well. So what you're looking at on the screen now is this draft of a concept proposal. And that really came from one comment that Kathy made, which is when you're writing the paper, that's not when you want to be soliciting who's going to help you write it. It should be when you come up with the concept. You know, you need to be identifying who's going to be working with you on this, and that person needs to be identified and working with you from the beginning, not tacking their name on at the end. And she's absolutely right. And so that led us to kind of come up with, again, this two-part proposal. So the first is perhaps the more important part, which is the concept proposal. And I'm just going to walk you through on my screen kind of what we talked about. So we talked about sort of the objective and general guidelines. And so within CFAS, what we want is, you know, very open communication within the consortium. And I think something really important that the consortium offers us the opportunity of, more so than we could do just with our own individual R01s, is the opportunity to do transdisciplinary and translational research. How can we put different pieces together, making our sum greater than our pieces? And we should have a concept proposal, and our approach to papers should really buy into that and give us ways to really leverage that. So what we're trying to do is ensure that all investigators within the consortium are aware of ongoing analyses or proposed analyses, and to foster collaboration so that we can identify investigators who want to participate in those analyses and have a meaningful way to do that, whether it's design of that analysis, the actual conduct of the analysis, interpretation of the analysis. And if we want that, we have to get people involved early. And that's really, I just restated what's in that paragraph. So the procedure would be a concept proposal. And if we really want to do this, it needs to be something that isn't so onerous that people wait to do it. So we talked about something that was really brief. Okay? We would post it on the CFAS website. We would mention it on these monthly calls. We talked about a template that would basically just have these elements, a brief summary of the hypothesis and concept. I'm not talking about the introduction of a paper. I mean, really, a couple sentences. What's the scope of what you want to do? What's the scope of the analysis? Are we talking about just working in animals? Are we talking about just working in humans? What kind of data are we talking about bringing things together with? And a broad timeline for completion. I think it's really important that people, you know, that this is sort of a, this is an idea I want to do. People then would be, it's the onus is on us, the CFAS investigators, to go look at concept proposals on a regular basis, perhaps before these calls. Look at what concepts are out there, and then contact the individuals or comment on those. There's ways we could do that online about how you can contribute to that analysis. And that way, we naturally identify our potential collaborators and our co-authors on these papers. So before I keep going, let me just ask, does anyone have any question about the idea or why we're proposing it in this way?
Tatiana, this is Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth.
We do something like this for another consortium I'm on, and I think also just, well, somehow to clear up within the scope of the analysis what data will be used.
I totally agree. So I can change that to scope of analysis.
And data utilized.
Data. Yep. Okay, no problem. But I guess I just want to see, for those of you who maybe weren't part of this committee, does it make sense that we're really putting the bulk of the idea, putting a way to find co-authors, again, early in the process, and again, the onus is on us to make sure we look at these. But I really think if we have these posted, mention that there are new ones on these calls, I think it's kind of a natural thing that will occur. I have in here, because I think it's a good recommendation, reminding people kind of what does it mean to be a co-author, and I haven't found which one I'm going to use yet, but we'll put something in here about different journals about what it means to be a co-author. But that's really kind of the idea about it, and the main thing is it's not binding, but I do think we need a timeline. So the reason that I just want to end with this piece is, you know, you're not bound to, oh, gosh, if you haven't finished this by August 31st, this is no longer your concept. You don't know. Somebody else can do it. That's not really what the purpose of this is. But we also don't want to tie up people putting in concepts and then never getting to them and then that work not getting done. So it has to have some dynamic element. And so what I'd recommend is probably proposals will need to get looked at maybe every 6 months. Maybe we'll do it as part of one of these calls. Are people still working on these concepts? What's happening? If we think this is important, but the person who originally proposed it, is it moving forward on it? Does someone else need to be, you know, someone else need to be moving this forward? So it's not binding when you put out a concept proposal. It's not like, you know, you must do this. But at the same time, if someone then doesn't plan to take it forward and other people have indicated they think it's an important idea, we need to make sure that we have a natural way for things that are important to get moved through our consortium. Anyone else have any questions about that?
Tatiana, this is Dale.
Hi, Dale.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. So I do like the idea of posting the concepts on the website, in the full detail. But I wonder if it wouldn't be helpful to people for a very brief email to be sent out when a concept sheet is posted, just so they're aware of it and they don't
overthink
think about it.
I think it's a great idea. Jill or Jennifer, would there be a way for that to happen so that when a concept was put out, an email could be triggered? Is that possible?
I'm sure that what we could do is at least send out a generic notification that something's been posted.
Okay. We could also,
are you thinking, Dale, of having something with the whole idea sent out?
I think a link to it would probably be enough, don't you think?
Yeah. Just so people know if it's up their alley or not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To go take a look, maybe a link included.
So
yeah, I think that certainly can be done, absolutely.
And I would stress, I think it's actually a great idea, Dale. And I would also say, I think it could be something that we did. It was one of the items on this call. It would take less than 5 minutes and just say, hey, this month we have 3 new concepts that have been proposed. In case you missed it, here they are. We show them on, you know, WebEx just like this. If you're interested, make sure you comment on it.
That's what I was going to recommend, that I could just have that be the waiting screen when people are logging into WebEx.
It's a great idea.
So another question is, what about stuff that's already in the works and ongoing? I mean, wouldn't it be good, I mean, not to hold anyone back as we're moving forward, but things that we've already started analyses that sort of give little descriptions of, like the Seth Peterson form.
Absolutely. I think it's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not to hold anyone back, but just so that everyone kind of knows what's in the works.
Yep. I mean, part of the thing is, like, when does this go into effect? So, I mean, as you can see, I still have a little comments in here. I still have a little bit of yellow in here. I think if we all agree with the principle of what I'm describing here, I think we could flip this very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
into a final document. And again, my main thing is to make this concept proposal pretty simple. So I had gotten from Bill, I got the thing from PASS, and that seemed really extensive. I think more than potentially I was thinking we would do. Do you disagree with me?
No.
Okay. I just wanted to ask. So for the committee, I had included that in the materials after Bill sent that. I didn't hear anything back, but I was a little nervous about just that it would become onerous and people might not complete. And I really want to keep this pretty simple, pretty easy, so that people will do it. I think, you know, the moment anything becomes difficult, it's less likely it's going to get done. And again, this is for anything involved in CFAS. So if it was a study, and I guess I probably need to hear from Kathy. So for Kathy, you know, this is, even if it was something that was purely, for example, work that was only in, say, in mouse, you'd still put in a brief concept. It may be that there is absolutely nobody else, but then everyone's aware this is going to get done. And if there is an opportunity to do something translational, it makes that opportunity really obvious. And if someone can see it, they can potentially, you know, comment to you about that. And potentially, you know, that could also change the impact of a paper, you know, could modify it. Do you agree with that idea?
I don't really know. For the basic science thing, I think one thing that one worries about, if you really don't think there are anybody else that would be able to contribute to it, you're almost giving away your ideas. You almost worry about getting scooped.
Within our group, you mean?
Well, I guess if we just keep it within our group.
Oh, this is only for CFAS. I mean, no one outside of CFAS is going to have access to this.
Okay, but if no one outside of CFAS has access to this, then how do you solicit, like, if other – isn't part of this to get other investigators that are outside of CFAS involved in
– Oh, no. This was – I'm not part of the data use. That's a different committee. That's Bill Barnett's committee for data sharing and all that.
Okay, so, all right. Well, as long as we stay within our group, then I think it's fine.
Okay.
And all the postings would be in the password protected area only for the CFAS investigators.
Yeah, okay.
This is Tina, Tatiana, and Kathy, are you thinking, though, that within the CFAS investigators there would be opportunities for these concept pieces to invite in, say, a junior investigator in your group who would be new to this, or would this be restricted to people who are already identified as CFAS investigators?
I hadn't thought about that. So I think it would have to be posted probably by a CFAS investigator, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Irene, nobody's going to be using this data that isn't somehow affiliated with CFAS. So I think part of our mandate, if you think about it, so I'm just trying to talk my way through this as I do this. I think, like, if you think about junior people coming into a group, you know, a young investigator, I mean, they still would, in order to have access to that data, they're still going to be linked to CFAS. So I would think a CFAS investigator might be the person who puts in that concept proposal and indicates that there's a junior faculty member or who is going to be working with the data, but presumably they're doing it under your IRB, you know, your
exactly. Yeah, so, I mean, I could see, you know, two or three people putting together a concept piece, posting it to the website, and another investigator would say, well, there's somebody in my group who would come under me who has some expertise in this area and might be able to contribute and to propose it to the concept proposers that they may be able to join the group.
So in that case, and, I mean, Kathy may want to listen to this in case this raises concerns. So, I mean, I don't think we want to be isolationist. I don't think that's what NIH wants us to be. I think we always want to be encouraging collaboration. What I don't think you probably want is somebody really loosely affiliated who suddenly runs with data and you know, doesn't have good authority over that. Is somebody, I feel like I'm not completely adequate to answer this question. Is there anybody else who wants to add to the response? Well, do you agree with what I've said, or do you think there's limits on what I said?
Something like agreement. But, you know, you could do something like data use agreement, but.
Yeah, I mean, I just think this is within CFAS. This comes back to Kathy's question.
Right.
Not the way you bring in somebody from another institution that you suddenly want to bring into this collaboration. I mean, that's not quite what I think we're describing here. This was intended for something within the CFAS investigative group. And you know, it's not bringing in somebody from a completely different institution. It's somebody that I think of it as being within, you know, within your IRB, a collaborator who is somebody who is really a close working with you and your group. I mean, this is not a mechanism by which somebody gets access to data.
Yeah, I agree.
That's right. Bill Barnett's data.
Right, that's a completely separate issue.
Yep. This is Michael Charnas. I came on late, and I heard part of this, and I think I have the gist. I'm sorry. I got to go off again. I have an idea. I'll be back.
We'll wait for you. Okay. I might keep going, but all right. So that I don't take up the whole hour, let me push this down. I'm sorry. Let me bring this back over here again. Sorry, I'm not as savvy as some of you. The other thing I wanted to show you is then the publication policy. So by setting this up the way we have, it actually makes the publication policy, and we had a big discussion about this and what its role would be, potentially different than I think what we had originally envisioned. So the purpose of the publication policy is to maximize the impact of the research done in the consortium. So we really want to ensure that all manuscripts generated by the consortium appropriately acknowledge the consortium and its grants. We want to make sure that the administrative core has a way to track all manuscripts, and importantly, that NIAAA is aware of all submitted and accepted manuscripts. And this is a little different than saying it's such a stringent scientific review. So we did still include, though, that the policy ensures that when requested, the CFAS investigators can get scientific input on manuscripts. But the purpose at this point is not to go find other co-authors. We would hope that much more naturally has occurred as part of the concept part. So what we changed in terms of the way we thought about the publication policy is now it's really kind of almost like a publication template. When you're ready to submit a manuscript and say, you know, I'm ready to submit it to a journal, what you would do is you would provide the manuscript and just this publication template to the administrative core about 1 week ahead of the submission. The scope of what we'd really be looking for is to make sure we know what journal this is going to, confirming that the appropriate acknowledgement has been included, and confirming that the appropriate grants are listed in the script. Okay? If requested, we can also assist with a scientific review. So that could be requested by the person submitting the manuscript who says, hey, I'd love to have some more input on this, make sure that I haven't missed something, you know, and within 2 weeks they could get that back. If there's any concern raised, okay, and you might ask, how might that be? So as this comes in, if suddenly, you know, Ed or, you know, whoever's, you know, on this committee looks at this and goes, well, wait a minute, this looks really shoddy, we might raise the question, hey, maybe this needs to just get a quick scientific review done within 2 weeks. But it wouldn't be that this would be a rigorous review at every time. It's really just to make sure we've got the highest quality papers coming out of the consortium. Last thing we talked about was the CFAS author and the acknowledgement text. So we talked about the advantages of having CFAS listed as an author. So a lot of consortium will just have as like the final author be the consortium. And the nice thing about that is it's certainly appropriate when we have multi-site authorship. So when we are using human data collected at multiple sites, that's a great way to be able to acknowledge individuals more broadly. And we just encourage people to consider this because it also becomes kind of a branding of the consortium. It's a really nice thing when appropriate. Now, if you had a paper solely coming out of Kathy's lab, I don't think having CFAS as an author makes any sense. But I think in a lot of the human papers, that's probably pretty likely that would be an opportunity. Or if it was a paper that was combining human and animal data, again, that might be a really nice way to encompass a broader authorship. And then the last thing we worked on was sort of a standard acknowledgement text so everybody knew what it was that they needed to say. And Jill actually provided us with something after I prepared this that can go there. So I think what's different about this kind of policy is that it's different than what we originally talked about a month ago is what we were going to have this committee do. I think we reformulated it into this two-step process and turned this last step of the publication policy more into an informing process so everybody's informed of what's going on. We've double-checked and made sure everything's acknowledged correctly. We give the opportunity for a scientific review, but we've hopefully turned this into something that's fast, rapid, not onerous for individuals, but keeps people informed of what's going on. Comments?
Well, I think that what you've outlined, I like the way you're emphasizing, you know, if requested and you know, because in another consortium I'm in, it is almost completely stifling to get anything done because of all of the review, the concept has to be reviewed and approved, and you can only use certain data, and they have to, you know, so it can be very stifling, but it also, I think, has, you know, with respect to informing the consortium, with respect to even just making sure that the right grants are acknowledged, I mean, I would, but
yep.
As long as we go too far over the edge of being oppressive, then I think that this is a really good idea.
Okay. Anyone else?
I think this is a great start. One section I may add, suggest to add to the publication template is maybe a section to ensure compliance with the NIH public access policy. Maybe just having the author identify which method for the journal they're submitting to.
You think for data sharing, is that what you're suggesting? Like if it was genetic data, like dbGaP or something like that?
Well, no.
No, you're.
To ensure compliance with the
right.
Access policy, maybe listing which of the methods, you know, A, B, C, or D.
That's actually really good, yeah. That's a great idea because otherwise we run into that problem when we have to put in the progress reports and we don't have something.
Yeah. Can I call it access compliance?
If you want to say public access, I think that's what the policy is called.
Mm-hmm.
And then that way, you know, Dale and I can help with ensuring that gets completed and that doesn't hold up an award.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Along those lines, maybe the specific PI who's going to be responsible for getting it done in a timely manner could be established, because some of these methods, like method D, some of you are aware of with ACER, the PI, after the journal does their piece, the PI have to follow up. And often the ball gets dropped at that stage, and then it's progress report time, and you're in a panic.
Okay.
But if we can make sure we know whose responsibility is, it might help.
Yep. How's that? And an individual who will ensure compliance.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, the only other things that we did on this group, I'm sorry, I took way longer, is we have a really nice summary now of grant numbers. So let me show you that real quick. So if you ever have a question about what grant is, which one, and who do I acknowledge, we have a nice little chart for that. I think we already had this, but it's all sitting right here and available. And so I think what I'll do is, based on what I heard now, I will make a couple changes, not a lot. And Jill, I'll probably ask you in the next day or so to circulate this to everybody, and maybe we'll give everybody, I don't know, like a week or so to comment, and then I think it'd be set. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah.
Okay,
good.
Perfect. All right,
good.
I'm done.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for taking the lead on this. Did Mike ever get back on to share his thoughts? Maybe not.
Pardon? He's not back. If he jumps in, maybe we'll get that information. If not, I'm sure we can. We'll make sure to solicit it so that the committee gets it. Anyway.
Okay. All right. You took it back, right, Jill or Jennifer?
Yeah, so thanks, Tatiana, and
thank
now
you.
We'll move to Deepak's talk.
All right, I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to just talk about some of the data we are getting and what you are doing and what you're thinking of doing in future. So as you know, my interest has been to look at the circadian gene and the gene which control the stress axis and how it relates to the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. The idea being if that they could be identified as a biomarker for recognizing fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, as well as they could be related or could be connected with some of the problem fetal alcohol patient gets. So there are, if you look at the literature, I think there are quite a bit of literature now been shown that prenatal alcohol-exposed kids, infants, go through lots of stress problems. There are several papers, not only in human, they are also evident in animal, in monkey, in rodent. So it's pretty clear that the stress axis is quite disturbed in this group of patients. But the interesting part is why and how it's not been known. But recently, there is a connection being made. As we all know, the fetal alcohol kids go through a lot of problems with their sleep disturbance. And so there is a connection being made that the sleep disturbance and stress axis might have an interactive connection. And with the disturbance in the sleep is really quite a few key components there. One of the components is the clock genes. And these clock genes are a set of genes, group of genes, and one gene particularly known as period gene. And period gene has several forms, part 1, part 2, part 3. And part 2 appears to be quite responsive to alcohol, and they are also get changed by stress axis. And they are also, we have recently published just last month, that these clock genes disturbance or clock gene mutation can really seriously affect the stress axis function as well as the metabolism. So goal of my current project, which I've been doing for the last 2 years, is to really see whether or not these genes are being modified. And as you know, that the when mother drinks and all those, the effect is really doesn't disappear. They make a mark, particularly in the genome. And recently, there's a big wave of literature coming out showing the epigenome might be quite a key component for these, the epigenetic mark. So the way one could look at those epigenetic mark, looking at the changes on the DNA methylation. So one could look at the histone modification, DNA methylation. So we are looking the DNA methylation of these several genes related to clock genes, part 1, part 2 we are looking, as well as the POMC gene, which we find are quite critical regulating the stress axis function. So the way we're doing the gene modification is measuring these the methylation by using these methylation-based RT-PCR, which we develop after long study in animals, where we find that these methylation-based RT-PCR are quite sensitive. And they could also critically, if you know exactly where those methylation go happening within the gene, you can then develop this RT-PCR and very, very quantitatively measure the changes of the methylation. And we are fortunate that and some of these changes we are finding are really showing very solid data. So we are using these assays, and also we are collaborating on multiple investigators in the CFAS. Our primary investigators so far are Tatiana and her group. They have really provided a large number of salivary samples from FSD children, as well as control and alcohol exposed children. And we are also collaborating, and we haven't received the sample yet, but with the Los Angeles group and the San Diego and Indiana, collecting salivary sample to measure hormones. The samples are getting collected. Hopefully, we're going to get some soon. And also, we are talking with Tina Chambers, looking at soon we're going to receive blood as well as the salivary samples from mothers as well as their children, mothers drinking alcohol control as well as their children. So our idea is to see whether this methylation changes are very specific to any group of fetal alcohol patients, or they are in general for any offspring which are exposed to alcohol, or it is specific for particular genes. So we have measured clock genes, part 2 and FOMC genes, and we are also interested to see whether or not they kind of correlate with the stress axis after we measure cortisols and testosterone in the saliva sample. And ultimate goal is really to identify a solid biomarker to recognize this FASD patient much earlier, either a group of FASD patient or all the FASD patients much earlier, so that treatment regimen can be put forward much earlier. So I have already described to you all the experimental paradigm. Let me show you some of the data we got. So we have received salivary samples from a large number of control and a relatively small number. Total is about 18 or so FAS and about 40-50 alcohol-exposed kids. And I think they are between 7 and 11 or 14 years old children. Now, we have received them into two sets. One is first trial, second trial, and we measured these part 2 gene and POMC genes. I think it's wrong here. Within the both time, we find that the POMC genes and part 2 genes is enhanced. So, that is the part 2 genes. So what did I do? First trial, second trial. One was the botan methylation. I don't know what you're doing here. The second one is, again, we are doing POMC methylation, and here we are finding that both were increased in both control, both alcohol-exposed and FAS patients. So our next thing was to look at whether or not these methylation changes is whether or not part methylation is only part 2 and POMC, not any other genes. So one of the closely relevant genes we looked at is called PAR1 genes, and when we looked at the PAR1 gene methylation, we do not find any significant changes of either of them, showing that it is very specific for part 2 and POMC genes. Whether or not BMAL and many other genes are changed, we have no idea. But if we have enough samples, and we probably will be able to look at to just to make sure it's a very specific group of clock genes get this mark. Another interesting thing we did, we wanted to see whether or not this epigenetic mark on these genes are not transient. This mark lasts for ages, because one would expect if you have an epigenetic modification happen within this developmental period, this could last to rest of your lifetime. And in order to do that, we were lucky to get some samples from the same patients in a longitudinal study after 2 or 3 years. And we do find that changes we saw within the PAR genes and POMC genes persist in older, in the longitudinal study after 2 or 3 years, suggesting that this epigenetic mark is persistent. And I presented some of this data during the last retreat in Washington, D.C., and I was being asked, or we started discussion that many of these alcohol drinkers also smoke, and many of the mothers smoke, whether or not the smoking has any effect on these gene methylation. And I'm being delighted to see that the smoking has no effect. If you can look at here, these are controlled kids. And the first group is a non-smoker group, and second group is a small smoker group. This is a quite a large population, tight error bar. There is no difference. Similarly, with the FAS population, which we have a very small number, that's why error bar is big, again, we do not find any difference. Nor we find difference in alcohol-exposed non-smokers and smokers. This is related to part two genes, and if we look at the POMC, we find a similar effect. There is no changes in smoker, in control, nor in FAS, or in alcohol exposed.
Deepak?
Yes.
So this is if the mother's smoking. Do we have any data whether the young adults, the older kids in this cohort, whether they're smoking themselves?
I think these children, I think Tatiana would be a better person to answer, but I think these children are too little to smoke because they are between 7 and 11 years old.
11, okay.
So we also looked at the PAR1 gene, which we didn't see difference in the methylation. PAR1 gene is interesting. It goes ups and down. There might be something going on. We do not know what's happening with PAR1 gene and smoking because the N values are small. So, again, here you see with the alcohol exposed, there's a big difference. So there might be something going on. I think we are hoping to get some more samples, and maybe we'll find a better answer on these. And it will be also interesting if we find a specific marker for smoker. Then it would be very easy to, that would be very useful for multitudinal kind of measurement. So this is very exciting, and I think I'm getting really excited. And the reason for excitement, I think this is starting to be very specific changes, and it will be really good to see whether or not these changes, gene changes, are correlated with the hormone changes. We are hoping to get those salivary samples soon and measure the cortisol and testosterone, and if there is some kind of interaction and measurement, will be very exciting. And most excitingly, which I'm waiting for, and I'm talking to Tina quite a bit, if we can see these changes in mother during drinking, and if we can identify those marks within the mother, we could immediately have a ability to intervene. So that will be the most exciting part I am really looking forward to. And when we get this, Tina has told me that she will be able to give me some both saliva and blood, perhaps, in the mother as well as the babies. And if we can find this mark turning on in mother and persisting in children, I think that will be really major excitement. So I already told you what we've been doing, and I think we are still quite a way to go. And I think that our expected outcome would be after the end of my developmental period. Hopefully, I could find some stable epigenetic marker for early detection of alcohol-related birth defect. I am really hopeful that it could be a very significant biomarker. And finally, I wanted to tell you, I don't want to stop here because I think this epigenetic modification is a very, very solid, exciting thing because in animal study, I'm really finding major novel stuff, you know, dealing with these transgenerational changes. I'm also started working with this histone turnover, finding some kind of new stuff. So I have a feeling this epigenetic part could be a major component for fetal alcohol research. And I would like to continue working with the human part because the animal part alone could not really resolve it. So my future plan, I would like to put a proposal to determine really a little bit more of the, some of the epigenetic changes, employing some more sophisticated stuff, looking at pyrosequencing, looking at the gene, where is the modification and changing place, then look at the chief sequencing, looking at whether or not this part gene modification, what are the other rest of the gene is getting affected, so that we can predict the disease connected with this methylation of these genes. I would also like to really get involved with some of the study in CIFAS going on with the choline, because we, in our animal study, we can see the choline administration in animal could reverse some of the epigenetic modifier, reverse some of the stress axis function. Folate is another important part, vitamins. So I wanted to see whether or not they have a significant alteration of this the epigenetic mark. And then perhaps it could be useful for a predictive marker for a stress outcome for choline, folate, or vitamin supplementation effect on FSD children. So those are the kind of thing I wanted to work on in future. But currently, I'm really excited with what we are finding so far, and I'm really really looking forward to those getting those additional samples to really solidly establish that these are some of the epigenetic marks can be used as a potential biomarker. And I'll leave it there, and I'll wait for questions.
The two questions, Deepak. This is Dan, in reverse order. And maybe Tatiana knows this. Do we have any information on the nutritional status of the children that were studied in these saliva samples?
Tatiana, no.
The saliva samples would all be from the U.S. population.
Right.
I don't think that there is, but I defer to Sarah Elizabeth.
Okay. And then the second question, I was a little bit confused, Deepak. You're suggesting or indicating it would be interesting to go back to the mothers of these children and do the analysis. But it sounded like you were thinking this may be a biomarker of exposure for the moms. But I really wondered if what would be interesting about that was, you know, were these changes already present in the mothers and they just carried over to the children? Perhaps the mothers themselves were prenatal alcohol exposed, and this is an intergenerational epigenetic effect that you're looking at, more so than thinking about it as a biomarker of exposure in the moms per se.
I think that's a very valid and interesting point. I think. But realize that if these, if it is a transgenerational effect we are talking about, that changes in mother will ultimately affect the offspring.
Mm-hmm.
So this is we are not doing just the one epigenetic mark. We are also looking its connection with some of the disease state. For example, the disease state I've been very interested in the stress axis abnormality and the sleep phenomena. So if the mother has it and if it is transmitting to the offspring, the disease or fetal alcohol-like syndrome might arise without drinking alcohol.
Right.
So, and that would be also an important thing to really identify.
Yeah, I think that's an important consideration about mm-hmm. whether these changes already existed in the moms or not.
Yeah.
Right.
Another question.
Hi, Deepak. This is Christina. Really interesting data. I'm wondering if you looked at correlations between these methylation patterns and cort levels. And I was also wondering how stable is the methylation pattern expression throughout a 24-hour period?
Okay, so cort level in human, I'm still waiting for getting the saliva, and I'll be doing it. For animal, yes, we have done that, and they are highly correlated with the cort data. Is POMC is a part of the regulation of cort, because POMC produce ACTH, and ACTH leads to the activation or increased cord or decreased cord. So in general, what happened in animals, the fetal alcohol exposed animals, offspring, their cord basal level is low, but when they have a stress, their stress axis get very hyperfunctional. And the reason behind that POMC at the brain, instead of at the periphery, is activate ACTA, activate glucocorticoid and corticosterone and cortisol. And in the brain, it suppresses CRH to keep the bring the hemostasis back, the stress axis hemostasis back. So when there is a low POMC in the brain, the response, you know, when the patient gets through a stress, they cannot bring down the stress back to normal very easily. They get a hyper response. So that we have seen it many, many times with a transgenerational study, many, many generation of these similar phenomena following alcohol exposures in animals. So I'll be really waiting to see what happened in humans after I get the salivary samples from these patients.
Any other questions or comments for Deepak? All right, well, thank you. And I think that Peter had some data that he wanted to show real quickly as well. So, Peter, we'll send the WebEx to you.
Okay. So I just have three slides. The first one is an update on the ultrasound project, which you've heard me talk about. This is with Alison Noble in Oxford. And these were 21. We were analyzing 21 3D ultrasound images kindly given to us by Hein Odendaal in South Africa. And if you remember, Tom Rackham, a PhD student of Alison's, had done some work, I think in March, April. This was in a four-month period, extracting midline profiles of the fetal faces. And then he gave me the shape of these things, and I did a shape analysis, and I produced a principal component that looked like this. It looks like a baby yawning and stretching, but it's varying the first principal components in the shape analysis of these 21 profiles between -2 and +2 standard deviations. And what struck me was that one part of the variation is size, from small to big, but if you look here at the philtrum, it's from concave to convex. And I thought, well, that's too good to be true. When it's small, it's more convex, and when it's larger, it's more sort of normal and concave. So we approached the PASS committee and asked if we could get some analysis from DMSTAT, and they looked at the values of this one principal component and compared it to the exposure data on these children. And they came up with a nice, well, certainly with one strong correlation. So this does correlate with the drinking in trimester two. It doesn't in one trimester one or trimester three. And these were the measures here. The first one and the last one I understand. The first one has just got not quite a significance. And this is drinks per drinking day by trimester. And then the last one is drinks per drinking week by trimester, which is significant. I actually don't fully understand the binge versus no binge, and I need to check with Faye Robinson exactly what that means. But I mention it because it is significant. So I think this is an interesting result and, you know, requires further investigation with larger numbers. So that's a quick update on that project, which, of course, ended in May, since it was only for 4 months. And then I just wanted to quickly update people on the face brain work, since there's been a lot of interest in us pushing it forward. Now, the results aren't quite so interesting so far, but And I wanted to emphasize that one of our problems, continuing problems, is getting enough data. So if you look at this table here, you can see we've got 3D photos in total on 316 individuals, and they break down according to control, FAST, PFAS, and the heavily exposed, like that. But by the time you look for a subset who've got data, for instance, like an MRI image or cognitive measures, the numbers go right down. And when you want all three, since what we're looking to do is to do face brain shape analysis and overlay it with cognitive measures, we're down to just 69. And in particular, the small number of controls, 31 here, means we can't apply the approach that Mike did in the pediatrics paper where, you know, we normalize everyone against controls and then just let the faces do the work. What we wanted here to do was to do the same, but we can't. So I just wanted to give you an example of what you can do. So instead of doing that kind of cluster analysis, you can do what's called a directed learning analysis. So, for instance, you could look at the average control shape of face and brain, or some face components and brain components, and compare it with the average of the FAST PFAS group. And if you do that kind of classification, you can get a success rate of correctly classifying controls as opposed to FAST PFAS on a scale of 0 to 1 like this. And what you notice is that when you combine the filtrum with the corpus callosum contour or the thin profile, you get the best results. So Mike had a closer look at this and to see whether we could get anything out of this by overlaying one of the cognitive measures that we have, for instance. So finally, what I'm doing on this slide is comparing the average face profile and corpus callosum outline for controls compared to the average for FAST PFAS. That's what I'm doing horizontally, and then vertically I'm looking at this measure with full-scale comp, which is a kind of IQ measure, vertically. And when I introduce the controls, which are the empty circles, and the FAST PFAS, which are the red circles, you see that there is a reasonable correlation between where these individuals fall on that horizontal scale of are you more like the average control or are you more like the average FAST PFAS. And vertically, as I say, is this sort of IQ measure. When we now introduce the heavy exposure, and this is where we're looking, for instance, is are they more like controls or more like FAST PFAS? When we introduce them, some of them are more like the green squares, for instance, are more like controls, and the green circles are more like FAST PFAS. And this is similar to what we did in the pediatrics paper, but as I say, I'm actually using a slightly different method for getting the separation of these heavy exposure individuals. And then when we look at the cognitive measure, we get that, as we did with the pediatrics paper, we do get a statistically significant difference between the heavy exposure are more control-like and heavy exposure are more FAST PFAS-like. And the means are quite different. The numbers are small. Another weakness in this is that we're still mixing here face and brain just to get an idea of that correlation. And also, as I said, I'm not using a clustering technique. I'm actually introducing the clinical labeling of FAST or PFAS earlier in the method. And that means it's not quite as strong as what we did in the pediatrics paper. But really the bottom line then is we can't really do the pediatrics style analysis unless we get more, in particular, controls. So we need, if I go back to that table, we need more, probably more MRI images is what will do it, because one of the additional difficulties in the cognitive measures is that, of course, different measures were used in different CFAS periods, you know, when we had CFAS 1, 2, 3, whatever. And Sarah is looking into maximizing our use of the cognitive measures to try and improve that. But I think really, as I say, what we need is more MRIs of the controls, which will help us do the normalization approach. And that's all I'm going to say.
So these are from CFAS 2 and 3? These are all the close that we traced and sent you. There are like 150 subjects.
Oh, these are all, by the way, this is restricted to Caucasian and Hispanic, so there's no Asian or African American in here.
Uh-huh. And another question, Sarah, are you on?
She's not on.
Okay. Who extracted the data from the repository?
Mike.
Okay. So, because I know that there are some kids who are discrepant in terms of falling between Sarah's younger and older age range, but I don't think that that should be an exclusion from this three-prong analysis. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I don't understand.
Okay.
I don't know that they would be. So the data would be in there, right? So what there is there's windows in which individuals meet the different criteria. They're either younger individuals or older individuals. And isn't there like 2 or 3 years in which they don't fall under either of the recruitment criteria, right?
Yes, but the point is,
right,
at least our site, there are data where that age criteria doesn't even matter for the imaging.
No,
so
would they have cognitive? I can't speak to this because we really do need Sarah for this one.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, would they have the right cognitive? So for the cognitive, are you looking for the same battery done across the whole age range? Would that be what you're looking for, Peter?
Yeah, we want to maximize the individual measures across as many
right.
as possible.
So you'd be looking for the same cognitive test done across the age range. So I don't think that would be an issue either. So if there was data on the individual on this test that's being used across the whole age range, or tests, plural, across the whole age range, I think, Mike, you would have pulled it because I don't think you're worried about which group they ascertain. I think only Sarah's worried about that for her analyses. I think I'm right.
Yeah,
you think?
Right. Mike mm-hmm. would have extracted as much as he could.
Mm. Yeah, so I don't think it's an issue, Elizabeth. We can certainly double-check, but I don't think it would be.
Okay, well, that's good. I just wanted to bring that up. But also, I think maybe I can help in some way because I just find it hard to believe that only 31 have the face, the brain, and cognition.
Well, do you
maybe I can add something.
Okay. So if you have you looked for, I mean, we could certainly give you a list of what we have. I think
okay.
we've gone back and forth because I think it's off the master list that we've been circulating around to make sure we weren't missing anything. Remember, we'd sent a list around after the ciliopathy call, I think, hadn't we, to confirm that we had the right images and that everybody had all the images that were available.
I didn't get any of that. I was not in that loop. So I talked about the ciliopathy, but I was not part of the loop of subjects, nothing like that.
Okay, let me go double check.
So maybe we can follow up on that to see which subjects, make sure that they're all in that list.
Yeah, let me double check that.
Okay. And then we're up at the top of the hour, so any other quick questions for Peter? Are you finding it now, Tatiana?
I do, but the problem is it was focused on heavy exposure,
yeah,
so it's not
yeah.
complete. It doesn't help.
So maybe that's something we can follow up after today's call. We are at 11 o'clock. Does anyone have anything else they want to add, questions for Peter or any other updates that people want to mention in just 1 or 2 minutes? Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.